The RISC e-learning webinar series is focused on scientific research and tools developed by the SRP grantees, collaborators, and other leaders in the field that can be used to promote health and resilience to climate-related disasters. Over the course of three sessions, presenters have discussed how they are incorporating multidisciplinary research, cutting-edge tools, and community engagement to understand how climate-related extremes increase the risk of exposures to harmful substances, how to reduce that risk, and how to protect human health. This session is the third and final installment of this webinar series. If you missed the first two webinars, the recorded archives are now available on the CLUIN website. A recording from today's session will also be available soon. And with that, we're ready to get started. So first, we'll hear from Dr. Naresh Kumar, an associate professor at the University of Miami. His research interests include time-space clustering of cancer incidents, mobile sensors and technologies, and exposure avoidance, and exposure to persistent organic pollutants and cancer risk. Dr. Kumar, I'll now turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share some of the research that we have been conducting. Let me share my PowerPoint before. Okay. Share. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can see your slides. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here to share some of our research that we have been conducting in Florida and also Puerto Rico. So today I'm going to talk to you about the redistribution of environmental pollutant in the aftermath of hurricanes and community health. To get started, since the theme is climate, I briefly want to touch upon the key aspects of climate. But before that, I want to declare that I have no conflict of interest in the motivation and conduct of this research, data collection, analysis, and their interpretation. And secondly, this grant was supported by NIH and also our internal funding from the University of Miami Department of Public Health Sciences. The seminar today is organized as follows. First, we will discuss about the linkages between climate, hurricane, environment, and human health. Then I will provide you with the background of Guanica Bay and a municipality in Puerto Rico, where we have been studying polychlorinated biphenyls. Data collection and analysis will be next. Followed by this, we will talk about changes in PCBs and other pollutant after the Hurricane Maria. Then we will discuss potential community exposure to PCBs after Hurricane Maria and the implication for exposure management. Okay. As you all know, the connection between climate and human health is pretty complex. Climate change, when to talk about the long-term impact, we are referring to a constant rise in the global surface temperature. Then melting of the snow, sea level rise, these are very long-term changes. To study the effects of these long-term changes, you do need data on the changes as well as the human health for a long period of time. However, most of these data are not available more than 30 to 50 years back in time. So conceptually, to quantify the health effects, long-term health effects of climate change, it has been very difficult because of these data are not available. On the other hand, however, when I think about climate change is also exacerbating many of the extreme weather events, such as forest fire, pollution transport, hurricanes, blizzards, droughts, flooding. And above all, many of these events, whether these are natural disasters or these long-term changes, they directly and indirectly modify the environment. So when we talk about the health effects of climate or extreme weathers, generally we are talking about the environmental changes, the way they exacerbate and how they magnify their impact on human health. For example, if we are really interested in the health effects of global increasing the global surface temperature, then we are talking about if the change is about 1.5 degrees centigrade by now, how does that affect lipid metabolism over time and how that can link to chronic disease? So as I mentioned to you earlier, such data don't exist to go back in time and study them sequentially. However, if you talk about any of the extreme weather patterns, these are acute effects and can be observed within weeks to months and after the year of these natural events. So nonetheless, even the short-term effects are attributed to changing climate. So when we talk about climate change, we're talking about the long-term impacts as well as short-term impacts that are mediated or modified by the environmental conditions. In the talk today, I'm going to talk to you about the hurricane impacts. So today I'm going to talk to you about the health impacts of hurricanes and the pollution redistribution. And here is a conceptual diagram of how does climate impact hurricanes, hurricane impact the socio-physical environment, and that in turn, directly and indirectly, modify the environmental stressors, and those stresses in turn impact health and well-being. On the other hand, there are several other diagrams, several other boxes you are seeing. The health impacts of hurricane can also be mediated by the individual characteristics. For example, their existing comorbidity, socio-demographics, their adaptation, preparation. Likewise, this can be also modified by household or the neighborhood environmental conditions. But nonetheless, hurricane direct impact will be, of course, such as wind force, drowning, electrocution, or cleaning the debris. So unintentional injury, these are the acute effects that you will see within days after the hurricane. On the other hand, if the home is damaged after the hurricane, then if there is a mold exposure taking place that will be happening for days, weeks, and months after the hurricane, then these impacts can persist for a long period of time and then can spill over for months to years. Now, ultimately, we would like to characterize all these stressors and for how long these stressors are exacerbated and related to those exacerbations, what is the net magnitude of mortality, morbidity, or even pregnancy outcomes. Now, with regard to the persistent organic pollutants, such as PCBs, if communities are living around a contaminated site, for example, some of these pollutants can be redistributed, resuspended, and these can begin to bioaccumulate in the food they bring, communities consume or the air the communities breathe. So our focus today is Hurricane Maria and how it could have stirred many of these persistent organic pollutants, including PCBs, and what has happened to the community exposure to PCBs in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. So our two key research questions are, do hurricanes result in the distribution and or redistribution of environmental pollutants, in our case, specifically PCBs and other persistent organic pollutants? And second, what are potential health implications of changes in the environmental exposures in the aftermath of hurricanes? Okay, I'm not sure if you all know. We are focusing on Guanica municipality. This municipality is located in the southern west part of Puerto Rico Island. And this island, this bay per se, is pretty, looking from the top, looks nice. It's about 3.5 kilometer stretch from the estuary to all the way mouth of the bay. Now, here is another view of this Guanica Bay. As you can see, this place has been abandoned by many of these old industries. Early used to be Ocha fertilizer plant, Pan American grain, and there is a very old abandoned Gonzales chemical plant. There is also an abandoned sugar mill. But at this point in time, it's just inhabited by people in three different townships. All these three townships belong to Guanica municipality. This is another overview, aerial photograph of the bay. So first, even looking from the top of the hill, it looks very pretty. And we wouldn't suspect it may be subject to many of these pollutants. So to begin with, I would like to acknowledge that our work, PCB work in the bay, was not started by our team. Rather, it was the effort by NOAA's first report that was published, I think, in 2009 or 2010. In this report, they say the ambient or the environmental PCBs, sediment PCBs in the bay were slightly elevated. And these were the sites where they monitored PCBs. And all of a sudden, that triggered my interest because I've been studying airborne PCBs as well for the past many years. And we started conducting field monitoring. As a matter of fact, we had a student who came from this part of the island and it became her class project. So we learned that in NOAA's report, the highest level of PCBs were recorded 1.918 part per million. And of course, say that's not too alarming, but given in other settings, you will still see this is relatively higher than what you will observe in many other settings. And that led us to do more investigation and started conducting more comprehensive sampling. Since I was looking at that the source could be, sources of PCBs could be from the estuary going all the way downstream, but that wasn't the case. Then I also conducted a couple of samples on the east coast of the bay, and this is where we detected high concentration of PCBs. In this case, I'm showing you two different sets of PCBs. One is the Aurochlor 1260 and 1260 Aurochlor. Aurochlor mean is just a mixture of some of these PCB congeners. It's a kind of mixture of some of these congeners. But when you analyze all PCBs, that's the sum of about 205 congeners. And we found that at the hotspot, the concentrations were 129 part per million. That was the second highest ever recorded worldwide. That led us to also conduct more transect sampling east coast versus west coast. And we have been studying PCBs in the Bay since 2013. So all of a sudden, then Hurricane Maria struck, and that, of course, triggered our interest. Because as you can see from the satellite imageries, this is the runoff after Hurricane Maria. This is before, and this is after. There is a significant amount of runoff from the stream, from upland, and also the stirring of the sediment. Our hypothesis was that this hurricane could have redistributed the sediment PCBs and perhaps airborne PCBs as well. So that's the genesis of this project. As you can see, the direct impact of Hurricane Maria was not as severe as in the southwest part of the island. Now, we started collecting comprehensive data since Hurricane Maria, but before that, we also had baseline data on the sediment PCBs, fish PCBs, and we then also conducted comprehensive environmental monitoring and monitored the PCBs humans' blood samples, and also conducted a survey in 2018 and 2019. So all the samples were analyzed for PCBs, heavy metals, using the standard EPA methods. Duplicate and field blanks were used to verify the recovery of these samples and also variation due to the duplication. PCB 103 and PCB 198 were used as a surrogate for sample recovery, and heavy metals were analyzed using ICP-MS. So here are some of the results. Aurochlor 1260, there was a significant increase. The value increased from 0.71 part per million to 2.8 part per million after Hurricane Maria. Now, when you look at only the eastern part of the bay, then there was a five-fold increase in Aurochlor 2060 concentration after Hurricane Maria. But when we have the sum of PCB congeners, then in the pre-Hurricane Maria in 2013 and 14, the values were 129 part per million, which increased to 460 part per million around the hotspot in this bay. And then we also conducted a follow-up monitoring in 2019, and we learned that there was a slight decrease in PCBs that declined to 385 part per million. Now, some of these dark purple dots you're seeing, we also monitored PCBs by deploying air samplers in several of the homes, on the roof of their homes. And these samples were run for 72 hours using high volume samplers. As you can see, in the hotspot near the bay, the PCB concentration, airborne PCB concentrations were 1,146 picogram per cubic meter of air. And when we have another sample deployed inland, about 8 miles deep, at the control site, the PCB concentrations were below 85 picogram per cubic meter. Likewise, We analyzed heavy metals. There was also a significant increase in the polyaromatic hydrocarbons, especially in the eastern side of the bay, when comparing 2013 data vis-a-vis 2019 data, which were 2 months, 2 years after Hurricane Maria. However, we did not see a significant increase in heavy metals after Hurricane Maria, but certainly there was a significant increase in PCB autochlores, total PCBs, and polyaromatic hydrocarbon. When we started sampling PCBs after Hurricane Maria, simultaneously we also started conducting fish sampling. And based on data that we collected, when we homogenized the fish, the concentration of the whole fish sample was 12.7 part per million. And in small fish, the number was slightly even higher. When we fished outside the bay, 3 miles away from the mouth of the bay, the concentrations were below 0.5 part per million, which is allowed by the FDA limits. So inside, as you can see, inside the bay, the fish concentrations in whole fish sample is greater than 10 microgram per gram. And outside the bay, it is less than 1 microgram per gram the bay. While studying the human samples, we had a sample of about 150 individuals. As you can see, we compare the PCB data in the residents of Guanica municipality vis-a-vis using enhanced data from the continental U.S. The concentration of PCBs in Guanica resident was 4,244 picogram per gram, compared to only 835 picogram per gram in the U.S. population. This is more than 5 times higher concentration or the body burden of PCBs in the residents of Guanica Bay. Then we also examine which congeners of PCBs are present in these samples. As you can see, autochlore congener 153, meaning there are not many congener which were in significant concentration below 90. Most of them are higher number congeners, which suggests that these are likely to be more persistent. Consequently, they are going to bioaccumulate more. While studying these samples, we also collected survey-based data and examined what kind of impact these people withstood. So in case of home damage, roughly 50% of the individuals reported they had some type of damage in their home, either physical damage or the water damage to their home. And asking them whether water damage resulted, or the home damage or water damage resulted in any of these signs of mold. As you can see, about 35% of the individuals reported some visible signs of mold in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. In case of power outages, most of the individuals had power outages less than one to two months, and 43% of the residents reported that they had power outages more than 2 months. Now, this is very interesting. We also asked them, what were their sources of food in the aftermath of hurricane? As you can see, most of them relied on the local supermarket, and some of them also relied on FEMA. When you look at the fish sources, local supermarket might be also supplying fish from the local soil areas, meaning maybe near the bay or outside the bay, a little bit outside the bay. So maybe it's susceptible to some sort of contamination. Now, we ask another question to these individuals, especially those who have been consuming fish or seafood for the past 20 years. What is their main source of fish? As you can see, still about 6.2%, 626 individuals reported that they still use the bay for consumption of fish. Some of them do rely about 39% on the local fish store. And there was another option, local fish store or inside the bay, half of them do rely. Meaning, quite a number of individuals might be subject to consuming contaminated fish. Then we also try to model the relationship between CRP, C-reactive protein concentration in serum sample and PCB. As you can see, individuals who have high concentration of PCBs also have very high concentration of C-reactive protein. Of course, this is a very bivariate relationship. There are a host of other factors, for example, body mass index, age, all these factors when adjusted for PCB concentration did predict significantly CRP, a marker of inflammation, in these individuals. Now, switching gears, I also want to show you, based on survey-based data, what is the magnitude of health impacts of hurricane? In this case, we interviewed individuals in Puerto Rico, in South Florida, in Panhandle, Florida, after Hurricane Michael. So Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Irma, and Hurricane Michael. And one of the questions we asked to these individuals, did you have any new clinical diagnosis of chronic disease after hurricane? And you'll be surprised to know that 33% of them confirmed they have new chronic disease after hurricane impacts. And now when you take a look, when do these impacts peak up? As you can see, most of these impacts peaks up between 3 and 5 months after the hurricane. Now, how do we explain it? Now, you might think about most of these new chronic impacts pops up between 3 and 8 months, largely because of a variety of environmental stressors that are exacerbated in the aftermath of hurricane. Here is also another interesting thing. We asked this question to individuals who have been clinically diagnosed of asthma and allergies. And those who we asked, did your allergy symptom or asthma symptoms worsen after hurricane impact? As you can see, 57.9% reported their allergy got worse. 48.3% reported their asthma got worse. So meaning you're talking about many of these external stressors, including allergens in the aftermath of hurricane, they can exacerbate some of these symptoms. Now, it was quite shocking to learn that we also asked questions to pregnant women. And we asked them whether you were pregnant before the landfall of hurricane. And you see, of course, our sample size was small, in which there were only 14 women reported they were pregnant. And 5 of them had miscarriages, two on the island, 2 in South Florida, and 1 in Panhandle. And of these 12, of these 14, only 2 have normal delivery. Either they have, five of them have miscarriage, and 7 of them have preterm birth. So in other words, hurricane impact may also be associated with adverse pregnancy outcome. Here we systematically document what role some of these environmental stresses could play in the aftermath of hurricane. Now, this is very interesting. We acquired data from all morbidity cases, meaning clinical visit or emergency room visits, from one Florida consortium. We have the richest consortium in the country, where many clinics do participate, and these clinics do serve about 70% of the Floridian population. And our analysis suggests that we partitioned these data for all patient visits, and patient visits who received allergy diagnosis, patient visits which received asthma diagnosis. As you can see, there was 1.21% increase in the emergency room visits after Hurricane Irma. And when we talk about allergies, there was about 4% decline in the patient visits to either emergency room or regular clinics. In case of asthma, on the other hand, there was about 4% increase in both emergency room visits and emergency room visit and also regular clinics. Now, comparing to the survey data, it's very counterintuitive. Let me revisit. In the survey data, we saw about 57.9% of the individuals reported their allergy symptom got worse, and 48.3% reported their allergy symptom got worse after the hurricane. So what does this mean? It means these individuals, are they not seeking care for allergies? Quite likely, this could be an underreporting. So if somebody takes just the clinical record data, that may not provide adequate picture of the health impacts of known life-threatening disease. Now, so changes in chromium, what are the potential implications? So an increase in sediment PCB was more than 3 times in the bay. Fish PCB level could have been increased over time. We did not collect systematic data at a different interval, but there is a strong possibility fish consumption could have been one of the potential sources of increase in PCB exposure. And there is a strong possibility of increase in PCB exposure through inhalation. If I just simply do the math, if an individual breathes about 0.5 liters of air at rest, takes 12 breaths a minute, and 16 minutes in 1 hour, and 24 hours in a given day, person will be breathing about 8,640 liters of air. Now, if you remember, at the hot spot, the concentration of PCB were 1,146 picogram per cubic meter of air. Now, on a conservative estimate, assume individual I divided by 3, assuming that only person is exposed to 1/3 of it, because that must have been increased, 3 times increased after the Hurricane Maria, then it will be that number. So in a given day, a person will be consuming about 3,285 picogram per cubic meter of PCBs every single day. Now multiply this number by 365 times 3, that will be quite a significant increase in body burden of PCBs. So it will be very interesting to see what has been happening to the PCB body burden of in the residents of Guanica Municipality several years after the hurricane, and what are potential biological processes that initiated due to these excess exposure. So you have the baseline exposure of PCBs, then you have exacerbated PCB exposure, and differentiating these two only can help us identify what will be the net impact of PCB exposure changed by Hurricane Maria. So what can we do to manage? So we've been engaging some of these communities how to avoid the PCB exposure. One of them, which we demonstrate to them, is simply removing the liquid part of PCBs. So simply rely on the fillets. When we examine PCB samples, whole fish versus fillet, even the contaminated fish, fillet will have the PCB concentration below 0.5 part per million, which is below the FDA limits. Second, to know about what time of the day air is blowing from bay to inland. When air is blowing from bay to the inland, then of course you don't want to stay outdoor during that time of the day, rather when wind is blowing from land to the bay. And likewise, better preparation from hurricanes can be one of the solutions too, to avoid exposure to contaminated food and air. Here is our team. In this transdisciplinary project, there have been a number of stakeholders who have been working with us very closely. Of those is Guanica High School. It has been very rewarding to involve them, because every year we have been organizing a poster session, engaging them, providing them some of this data to prepare some of the flyers, distributing the community, talk to the community members, and also spreading the knowledge about the contamination and their potential health impacts to the kids. So spreading this information from children in school to their family and parents. Then we also worked with community member. For example, this is one of our co-PI, Dr. Solo Gabriel, and he's the librarian, to dig into what have been the potential sources of PCBs in the Bay. Then we have a local NGO, Protected de Cuenca, who have been our partner in this project. Sarah Doak is one of our coordinators, and these are two of our community members. So we have been organizing community activities during church time, or there's a local marathon, to disseminate this information and what kind of measures community members can take to mitigate some of their exposures. Okay, now I thank you, and more information about the project can be found at this link. I will be happy to take your questions if you have any.
Great. Thank you so much for the presentation. There's a question by John Hyde in the Q&A. So mm-hmm. Why do you think the PCBs, PAHs, et cetera, were higher after hurricane, but heavy metals were not?
Right. So I'm not sure if in one of the maps I showed, the most likely sources of PCBs is on the eastern side, for example, Gonzales chemical plant. And whenever there is rain or something, especially after Hurricane Maria, it could have been one of the sources. So per se, still we don't know what is the likely source of PCBs in the bay. And that's why this place is likely to be considered to be added in the national priority list or Superfund site list. And Ocha fertilizer plant is considered to be one of them. So anytime there is a drain or rain, those could be one of the sources of PCBs. So first, okay. I can't answer what could be one of the reasons that it is coming from eastern part of the bay. But wherever you will see PCBs, in those areas, you will also see used oil, like the petrochemicals.
Interesting. And there's another question. How far along were the 14 pregnant women? Were they mostly past the initial stages of pregnancy when miscarriage chances are higher than later in pregnancy? So approximately 12 weeks.
Yes, absolutely. So we asked this question, if you were pregnant and for how long you were pregnant, I think the average time was 5 to 6 months.
Okay, great. Thanks. Let's see. There's any others? Let's see. Okay, there's another question just popped up. Wonderful presentation. With respect to preterm birth, have you attempted to determine what the cause of this may be, e.g. limited access to healthcare services versus environmental contaminant exposure? And how do the rates of preterm birth compare from prior to the hurricane and afterwards?
All right, this is an excellent question. And right now I don't have answer to this question, but nonetheless, if you think about access to healthcare delivery, this is a major concern. Most of the Puerto Rican did not have access to healthcare even 6 months after the hurricane. That's for sure. Secondly, dramatic disruption in the food supply. So women who were consuming regular food, engaging in exercises, those things were also interrupted dramatically. So in other words, you have to factor in all these environmental exposure that occurred, including mental disorder, and all these things can pile together to result into preterm births. But to answer the question, it does require some serious measurement of all these environmental conditions, meaning the recruiting the woman even during the pregnancy and follow them up whenever there is any natural disaster, and measure many of these stressors as they are changing over time.
Great. Thank you. And Claudia asks, are there any mitigating factors or mitigating efforts underway to lower the PCB exposure in this population?
Of course, to my knowledge, no. However, there are municipality-wide efforts in place to disseminate flyers. For example, contamination of the fish using PCB, contamination of the fish, not PCB per se. When we started working in this island, many of the people even didn't know where the PCBs were, and they even didn't suspect the bay was too much polluted. And through over time, through some of our efforts, now about 70% of the community members do know what PCBs are and what are potential sources of contamination in the bay. So the awareness is spreading. We are distributing flyers. Likewise, municipality is posting signs that fish in the bay is contaminated. As a matter of fact, fishing is not allowed in the bay. But despite this, because the bay is surrounded by different homes, assume for a scenario, an individual who lost his boat after the hurricane and maybe disabled, then what do? You have no other choice but to put a rod and harvest some seafood. But on the other hand, if you have no other choice and you have to stick to the contaminated food, one of the best solutions is removing the lipid part and the organ parts. You have already reduced a significant amount of PCBs, because PCBs are lipid soluble. And as a result, if you remove some of this lipid part and the organs, the concentration of PCB will be very low. So these are the kind of flyer we are circulating in the community, among the community members to mitigate some of these effects.
Great. Well, thank you so much. There's a few other questions that popped up online in the Q&As, but it's time to move on to the next speaker. So if we wouldn't mind, just if there are any other questions, go ahead and type them in. And Naresh, if you wouldn't mind answering them in the chat, that'd be great.
Yes, I will be happy to do so. Thank you. I much appreciate it for your questions. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much. And again, please, if you have any questions for Dr. Kumar, please go ahead and put them into the Q&A section, and Dr. Kumar can answer them directly in the chat. So up next, we'd like to switch to the second presentation. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Deborah Watkins, a research associate professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Her research is focused on exposure to environmental contaminants during critical life stages, including pregnancy, early development, puberty, and menopause. Dr. Watkins, I will now turn the floor over to you. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Let me just share my screen. There, can you see my screen in the correct version?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. Let me just move things around a little bit. All right. So thank you so much for that introduction. And thank you to the organizers for the invitation to present today. I am an environmental epidemiologist at the University of Michigan and an investigator with the Vertex Superfund Center. Oops. Sorry, trying to figure out how to advance the slide. There we go. Okay. So the Protect Superfund Center is based at Northeastern University, but is a collaboration of several universities and other collaborators, including the University of Puerto Rico and the University of Georgia and Cornell University. And I do want to start by acknowledging the people within the Protect team who have helped make this work possible. So the focus of PROTECT is the northern coast of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico has one of the highest rates of preterm birth and infant mortality in the US. Puerto Rico also has over 200 hazardous waste sites on the island and around 18 Superfund sites, some of which are positioned above aquifers in highly permeable karst geologic formations. Puerto Rico also has a high rate of poverty. For example, in 2020, the median income was just over $20,000 a year, compared to the US overall median income of around $67,000 a year. So the overall aim of the PROTECT Center is to study exposure to environmental contamination in Puerto Rico and its contribution to adverse pregnancy outcomes, including preterm birth. So this schematic shows the overall structure of PROTECT. And I don't want to go into depth here, but I do want to show how the Environmental Epidemiology Project, which is the birth cohort they're going to be talking about, how that fits into the larger picture of PROTECT. So there's an epidemiology project, a toxicology project, as well as two environmental engineering projects. So the PROTECT birth cohort has been ongoing since 2011, the goal of which was to investigate environmental, demographic, and lifestyle factors related to exposure and preterm birth risk. Women are recruited into PROTECT at their first prenatal visit to participating clinics at less than 16 weeks gestation. In order to be included in the cohort, women have to be residing in the northern karst region of Puerto Rico and to be between 18 and 40 years of age. If women have gestational or medical complications, such as pre-existing diabetes, hypertension, or multiple gestations, they are excluded, as well as if they use oral contraceptives within 3 months of becoming pregnant, or if their pregnancies are from assisted reproductive technologies. So this table shows some of the data related to PROTECT. I think these are a few months old now. So now we have over 2,000 participants with completed pregnancies in the cohort. So women in PROTECT participate in 3 visits during pregnancy, during which they provide information on demographics. They complete product use and food frequency questionnaires, as well as scales for perceived stress, social support, and depression. They also provide a urine sample at each visit for the measurement of biomarkers of exposure. And then after delivery, we abstract birth outcome information from medical records. And this is just showing some of the characteristics of participants in the PROTECT cohort. On average, participants are around 26 years of age upon enrollment. Over 60% have a household income of less than $30,000 a year. 42% have a bachelor's degree or higher. And there's actually very low prevalence of smoking or exposure to environmental tobacco smoke. And for over 40% of participants, this was their first pregnancy. So the PROTECT birth cohort study was progressing very well when in early September 2017, Hurricane Irma hit Puerto Rico. And then just 2 weeks later, Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico as the most powerful hurricane to hit the island in over 80 years. There was a complete collapse of the electric grid, water systems, telecommunications, roads, and many homes were destroyed. All of Puerto Rico lost electricity and cell phone service, and half of the population lost water service. There was an estimated cost of over $100 billion in damage and resulted in over 3,000 deaths. And I know this number is a little controversial. There are estimates that have ranged from like 2,000 to 5,000, I think. But this is the official death toll of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. These are some pictures of what it was like in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, with flooding and destruction of roads, buildings, and the power grid. There was also a widespread concern over access to clean drinking water. So as I mentioned, about half of people did not have access to public water, but even people who did have public water, there was concern over whether or not that water was safe to drink or not. So to put the PROTECT cohort in context with Hurricane Maria, the red pins on this map are PROTECT study sites. So they're the clinics where participants are recruited into the study, and most of them live in this area. And then the red line is the path of Hurricane Maria. So you can see that our participants, as well as our research team in Puerto Rico, were profoundly affected by the storm. So in the aftermath, the PROTECT team ensured the safety and welfare of team members. First of all, we did have team members that actually lost their houses in the storm. But other team members ensured the safety and welfare of team members, study participants, community health center partners, as well as members in the surrounding communities. They distributed water filtration systems, which you can see, these are the orange buckets in the picture on the right with the filters attached, as well as packages of diapers, baby food, baby wipes, mosquito nets and repellent, and hand sanitizer that they distributed to participants and the communities. So once the immediate aftermath was over, we started thinking about the long-term effects of Maria on PROTECT participants. Previous research on hurricane exposures, which were primarily based on hurricanes Andrew, Katrina, and Sandy, showed that hurricane exposure was associated with long-term physical and psychological health consequences. And specifically in pregnant women who experienced a hurricane, they were at higher risk of preterm birth, as well as low birth weight and other adverse birth outcomes. However, it's not really known whether health effects related to hurricanes are due to physical, biological, or chemical exposures, or increased stress, or whether it's a combination of these factors. In addition, I think the impact of Hurricane Maria on Puerto Rico was unique in some ways. First, the island is geographically isolated, making it difficult to move people and supplies. There was also such a prolonged recovery period that I'm concerned that this could have a dramatic effect on the health of the population. Also, given that with climate change, the frequency and intensity of storms are increasing, we wanted to see what we could do to keep pregnant women safe and healthy in the future. So at the time of Hurricane Maria, there were 102 pregnant women actively enrolled in PROTECT and 74 additional women who became pregnant within the 5 months after the hurricane, who then enrolled into the PROTECT study. And we were, again, we were concerned about these participants because flooding and damage potentially exacerbated already present groundwater contamination, and we didn't know whether this had an impact on drinking water or not. There was also widespread use of diesel-powered generators that could potentially lead to increased exposure to PAHs. Also, increased intake of processed and packaged foods and bottled water could lead to higher phthalate exposure. And also increased, we were worried about the effects of increased stress and trauma. So to address some of these questions, I received an R21 to investigate the impact of Hurricane Maria on prenatal stress, environmental exposures, and birth outcomes within the PROTECT birth cohort. This work utilizes urine samples that were collected both pre and post Maria as part of PROTECT to assess changes in exposure to PAHs, metals, phthalates, and phenols. And in approximately 1 year after Maria, we administered a phone questionnaire on hurricane-related experiences to hope to identify sources of exposure and stress. So this graphic, again, shows the PROTECT study design and how the hurricane study utilizes questionnaire data and urinary measurements, again, of metals, PAHs, phthalates and phenols at the prenatal study visits, which could, again, occur either before or after Hurricane Maria. And in a subset of participants, we administered the Hurricane Experiences Questionnaire in the fall of 2018. Of the 176 participants that were eligible for to answer the Hurricane Experience Questionnaire, 122 completed it. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but we learned that on average, respondents were without electricity for 108 days. Almost half had structural damage to their home. And of those, about 40% had not yet had that damage repaired. 98% reported bottled water as their primary drinking water source, which is higher than prior to the hurricane. And only 14% of participants did not have a generator, although there was some trouble getting fuel. So when I went to compare environmental exposures from pre and post Maria, I used the overall PROTECT cohort, and we compared urinary biomarkers of exposure. So to do this, I created a variable I called hurricane status, which categorized each study visit and the samples collected at each visit as either before Maria, within 3 months after Maria, 3 to 6 months after, or greater than 6 months after Maria. So for the urinary biomarkers, again, they each sample had a designated hurricane status value. I also standardized for specific gravity to adjust for urinary dilution, and natural log transformed the biomarkers. So to look at the models I used, I entered hurricane status into linear mixed effects models to as a predictor of exposure biomarker concentrations. The mixed model adjusts for within individual correlations over time. So if women contributed more than one sample, this model took that into account. Models also adjusted for maternal education and income, and effect estimates are presented as the percent change in geometric means. So this table shows the number of urine samples that fell into each category. Phenols were, as you can see in the bottom row, phenols were not measured in all the samples collected in the 6 months after Maria. So I've combined the less than 3 months and the 3 to 6 months categories for that analysis. All right, and so again, remember women can contribute up to three samples. So these numbers are for samples, not women. I believe in the less than 3 months category, the 67 samples were actually from 48 different participants. All right, now for some results. When we looked at post-hurricane urinary PAH concentrations, we expected to see higher levels because of the widespread use of generators. But instead, we actually saw pretty drastic decreases in several PAHs in the 6 months after Maria. For example, there's a decrease of 15 to 45% of most PAHs. The exception was 2-hydroxynaphthalene, which didn't decrease and then increased in, you know, after 6 months of the hurricane. So I'm not really sure why that might be. My hypothesis for this is that decreased traffic post-hurricane and possibly changes in diet, which is another source of PAHs, may have led to decreased PAH exposure. So this is not what we expected, but good news in regards to exposure. When we looked at urinary metal concentrations post-hurricane compared to before Maria, we saw a 75% increase in cobalt, nickel, and 25% increase in copper in the first 3 months. But then these levels started to return back to pre-Maria levels. One of the most interesting findings here, I think, is the 80% decrease in manganese with a slow return to pre-Maria levels. It's interesting in comparison to a study by Lin et al., which is who works with April Gu, who is also part of the PROTECT research team, who measured measured metals in tap water. And they found that there were higher levels of arsenic, manganese, nickel, and copper in the tap water samples. However, we're seeing much lower levels of manganese in the people. So, only 2% of respondents reported actually drinking the tap water. So my hypothesis is that changes in drinking water sources led to changes in metal and metalloid exposure. So again, with the exception of a couple increases in metal exposure in the immediate aftermath, for the most part, metal exposure either decreased or remained the same after the storm, which again is good news in relation to exposure. In regards to phthalates, we saw decreases in several metabolites after Maria. An exception to that was metabolites of DEHTP, which is a newer replacement phthalate, which they are at the bottom of the plot here. So you can see they look very different than all of the other phthalates. So I think some of the decreases that we're seeing here are due to overall trends in phthalate use in consumer products and not necessarily a result of Hurricane Maria. However, the increase in DEHTP, the dramatic increase that then starts to go back to pre-Maria levels, I think this is possibly due to the storm. So again, my hypothesis is that increased DEHTP exposure is due to increased use of packaged and processed foods, as well as plastic use. For phenols and parabens, we generally see a reduction in exposure after Maria, even after 6 months. For example, there's a 61% decrease in benzophenone 3, which is a UV filter, after Maria, and a 50 to 90% decrease in antimicrobials, triclosan and triclocarban. I think specifically the antimicrobials, triclosan, triclocarban, were banned from use in some personal care products around this time. And my hypothesis here is that differences in exposure are more due to trends in chemical use in products rather than Hurricane Maria. So to summarize the findings on post-hurricane chemical exposures among participants, we found that higher levels of phthalate replacements used as plasticizers in food packaging and processing saw that despite increased metal concentrations in tap water, changes in drinking water sources post-hurricane likely contributed to changes in metal exposure. Widespread use of gas-powered generators post-hurricane did not actually result in higher PAH exposure. and potential changes in diet and reduced traffic post-hurricane may have led to lower pH exposure. All right, so now I want to talk about some of the challenges in this work, evaluating changes in birth outcomes. Has been particularly difficult due to the low case numbers of preterm birth and other adverse birth outcomes in the aftermath of Maria. Evaluating other outcomes has also been a bit challenging, as there's some suggestion in the data that the demographics of our participant population changed a bit during the hurricane and the aftermath, which could introduce some important selection bias into our analyses. Although withdrawal rates, as you can see here, from PROTECT remain the same during this time, it has been established that like thousands or even hundreds of thousands of people left Puerto Rico after Maria, which could definitely impact studies of hurricane exposure. Timing of this work was also a challenge, as we weren't able to administer the hurricane questionnaire until a year after Maria, and further work regarding the impact of Maria actually couldn't start until 2019. So the next steps for this work are to look at, evaluate the impact of Hurricane Maria on child development among kids that are in some of our follow-up studies. In addition, we are also examining the effect of the Hurricane Maria on maternal mental health. In conclusion, found that hurricane-related changes in environmental contaminants, behavior, and diet can lead to changes in exposure with potential health consequences. And going forward, we aim to inform practices regarding specific vulnerabilities of pregnant women and young children during a disaster to mitigate the effects of future storms. And there are far too many people to include on an acknowledgement slide. So this, I want to show this, which is a picture of the PROTECT team and our external advisory board at our last annual meeting. So thank you.
Great.
Happy to take any questions.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Watkins. So as Dr. Watkins mentioned, please go ahead and type your question into the Q&A pod in the lower right corner for any questions you may have. There's one here asking, is there a correlation between decrease in level of metal concentration and bottled water use?
Actually, it depends on the metal. I think it prior to Hurricane Maria, there were some metals that were related to drinking bottled water, including decreases in some metal concentrations, whereas there's some increase in others. After Maria, I think that it changed because less people are drinking tap water. So it's unclear whether the metal exposure is due to the tap water or bottled water use. So the answer is yes, and it's complicated, I guess.
Okay, understand. There's another question. How has the most recent storm, Hurricane Fiona, impacted the PROTECT cohort research, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think Hurricane Fiona did not impact the northern part of Puerto Rico as much as like other storms had. So our team recovered quite quickly. They lost power, but regained it fairly quickly. But then part of our team volunteered at other recovery efforts in other parts of the island that were more affected. So I think from our experience from Hurricane Maria, as well as several other, Puerto Rico has also had Zika, as well as COVID, as has everyone else. I think we've learned to be much more flexible and responsive in relation to events that come up. So I think Fiona was an example of that. So we could just begin helping other parts of the island that needed it.
Great. Thank you. Did you measure black carbon and VOCs, which are likely to be higher due to generator use?
No, we did not.
That's okay. Let's see. A lot of questions coming in now. What does your research indicate for emergency response actions and activities following a natural disaster?
Right. Well, I think, again, that's something that we've learned, that we need to be prepared for anything. And knowing what we need to help our participants who are pregnant women and, you know, much more vulnerable and have specific needs in cases of emergency. So in regards to why, you know, overall emergency response, I think we've just learned to contribute where we can and to make sure that we have what is needed for our participants and our team.
Great.
And I think we have a community engagement core that is at University of Puerto Rico. And I think that's something that they're much more involved with.
Excellent. What are the next steps for the study?
Right. So next steps, want to look at child development. So with children that were, either, infants or, young toddlers at the time of the hurricane. And we can now, if we've been following them up through other studies, we can look at how exposure to the hurricane at that time in their life affected their subsequent development. So both neurodevelopment, growth, things like that, as well as looking at mental health. There's some different ways I want to look at mental health from before and after the hurricane.
Are you also going to look at any older populations as well, or is it just children?
Well, we don't really have access. So for the PROTECT cohort at the time of Hurricane Maria, like, it was primarily pregnant women and their children that we were following. So we don't really have older participants in the cohort. Now we are starting to follow the mothers after pregnancy, but that is just a very recent development. So we aren't really able to look at hurricane, the effect of the hurricane on them, okay. At least Hurricane Maria.
Okay. No, I appreciate it. I think that's all the questions we have in the chat. So in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and thank you very much for a very fascinating presentation. And we'll move on next to our next speaker.
Great, thank you.
So next we'll hear from Dr. Kim Anderson, the head of the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State University. Dr. Anderson's research focuses on the field of environmental forensic chemistry, which involves the application of chemical concepts to the interpretation, distribution, speciation, and bioavailability of chemicals in the environment. Dr. Anderson, I'll now turn the floor over to you.
Thank you, Richard. And could you let me know which screen I'm sharing?
It looks like I'm seeing the presenter view.
Okay, just a second. How about now?
Looks great. Yeah,
that's better. Slides now.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you all. And thanks to all the organizers for the invitation to share some of our work and being a part of this very interesting session, as well as the general sessions that preceded us. So the title's a little different than what I shared. I'm going to talk about three different case studies that we have in the Arctic, and then also a study that we're doing with wildfires. And also, to follow on the previous two studies, we're going to talk about a hurricane study that we also have case study. One of the things that we do in my group is use a technology called passive sampling. And the reason for using passive sampling are multifold. One, we can detect much lower concentrations. So we can get down into the very, very low parts per trillion, sometimes lower. But most importantly, we're measuring a concentration with our passive sampling that really mimics what's biologically available. So it's important when we're looking at these health endpoints that we understand what's not the total concentration in the environment, whether it be air or water or sediments, or individual exposures, but to try to make that interface of understanding exposure science and the ways in which we do exposure science to most closely connect with what is biologically available, and then of course potential health effects from those things that we have exposures to. So we use what we call, or what is known in the field as passive sampling, and those can take the form of different kinds of polymers and can be used in lots of different ways, as I mentioned, in multiple environmental compartments as well as on the individuals. So we have both carbon and silicone-based polymers. And again, as I mentioned, they sequester, they take up into the polymer itself. It's not a surface reaction. It is an actual absorption into the polymer, the chemicals that we're interested in. And really, it's a really very, very wide range of chemicals, from PCBs, organic, other types of organic chemicals, PAHs, and phthalates, flame retardants. I'm trying to go through the list of all the chemicals that have been talked about here this afternoon. And through that, then we can concentrate them in these passive sampling devices and assess chemicals in the actual compartment, whether it be air, water, or sediments. But we also have a way in which we can set up these passive sampling devices to understand movement of chemicals. And when I say movement, not just movement within an air mass or within a water mass, but movement of these chemicals between these compartments. So in the case of weather or extreme weather, we can actually tell whether or not a chemical in the air mass is depositing into the water, or if the water is actually releasing the chemical into the air. Similarly, we can tell if the sediments are releasing contaminants into the water, or is the water depositing contaminants into the sediments. And this is important for understanding not only our environment and how that would relate to exposures, but it also lets us understand how extreme weather is moving these chemicals. And it also is important for remediation to understand how chemicals are coming into the system, whether they're contemporary or legacy, or whether or not ways in which to affect remediation. So today I'm just going to talk about how this fate, this chemical movement happens in some of these extreme weather types of locations, and how then that could affect our exposure. So there's also ways in which to simulate bioaccumulation and understand mixtures, which I won't have time to talk about today. So focusing in, we've used passive sampling in other kinds of environments, but I'm going to focus today on extreme weather. So the way in which we sample with our passive sampling, as you can see in step one, is whether or not we have samplers in the sediment or in soils. In the case of terrestrial, like wildfires, have them in the water, have them in the air, and we can now pull those samples from those compartments in various ways and analyze them in our laboratory. And again, we're not focused on any one particular set of chemicals, although today I will talk a lot about polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, but broadly we look for hundreds of endocrine disruptors, we look for hundreds of personal care products, dozens and dozens of flame retardants, industrial and pharmacological, hundreds of pesticides, dioxins, furans, PCBs. So all of these chemicals are sequestered in those passive sampling devices. And when we do this analysis, we're able to parse out any one of these within a very specific high sensitive method, or we have a larger screening method where we can quantify in a targeted way 1,500 different chemicals. And so that gives us really a lot of insight in a very targeted fast. So I can get these analyses done, that day for dozens and dozens of samples. It's not a super labor intensive in that sense. And it's really hard in these extreme weather situations to always know a priori what are some of the exposures. We can guess, of course, but we only guess on past knowledge. And I think it's important that we have some techniques that aren't based on our previous assumptions and biases of what is present. And so that's what this method affords us with many chemicals. The first one I'd like to share with you is a project that we have. It's a small pilot project in St. Lawrence Island. It's in the Bering Sea near the Arctic Ocean, and it's a community engaged project. And what we were asked about was as extreme weather happens, the question was, are contaminants that have been legacy sort of locked in the permafrost, are those becoming more available? Are they moving? Are they an exposure risk for our community and the children that play in the area? And so we were asked to look at some specific chemicals relative to this a community in St. Lawrence Island. And on the figure on or the map, a drawing on the right, are a lot of letters and numbers, and those represent where the Corps of Engineers have identified any kind of possible source place where contaminants may have been essentially things may have been buried, I guess. And I won't go into a lot of detail of what all those things are, but various things that could have been buried during the Cold War, during World War II, and that could be a source of contaminants. So as you can see, there are a lot of them, although they mostly tend towards the north and or potentially the south end of the of Troutman Lake. I will notice on the west side is an airstrip, and there's also a 4x4 track there. So this particular island is, it was interested in the movement of chemicals, specifically chemicals that could be coming from sediments and remobilizing into the water. But they're also interested in air pollution, more contemporary types of exposures, or if the lake was actually releasing through a sort of a process from the sediment to the lake into the air, in order to better understand exposures. So we looked, like in the slide previously, we looked at sediments, water, and air in those locations that I just showed on the map around the lake. And before I get into how chemicals are moving, I want to give you a sense of, this is a three slides of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And in the upper right-hand slide, you can see the community in Alaska, the water concentration relative to some of the other places we've been historically is relatively low, as you might expect. In the top left-hand, we see that the air concentrations rather are also rather low. And so what we're really interested in though, is the movement of these chemicals, because that was one of the questions that the community has. So understanding what we call flux, movement of chemicals, how is the movement of these chemicals that are in the atmosphere and in the water moving relative to that interface? And the ways in which we can show that is, on this lower figure where I have a series of pHs, and a negative value indicates deposition from the air to the water, and a positive value indicates release from the water to the air. And while these concentrations are quite low, what we see is that in fact, there we have deposition of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, a lot of alkylated polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And we see in the four corners of that lake, that we see that on the west side, whether it be the north or southwest side, near where the 4x4 trail is and the airport, we see larger deposition. So, of air, pHs into the waters, and much smaller on the east side. Even though this is not an especially big lake, you can see these sort of very clear geographic trends. I will say overall, these are small numbers, as I mentioned, but it is interesting to see that these are depositions. And so one of the concerns the community had was, are we getting contaminants from leftover buried waste that broad, whatever all those things are in that broad term. And what we found is that pH is an error depositing to the waters. We also looked at PCBs, which we didn't find any PCBs, very low concentrations. But we also wanted, the community wanted to know about flame retardants, PBDEs. What we found is that TSAP and triphenylphosphate, the one I'll talk about the most here, and again, this is a flux. So a positive value above zero means release from the sediment now. Now we're down in the sediments into the water. So from the sediments to the water, and we see mostly deposition, whereas one site we do see some release. The key with this also is to recognize that TPP has other uses beyond flame retardants. We would have to look more into this. In general, you can see from even the previous slide where I said the flux was small, you can see from the scale here that the flux for these particular two compounds is even smaller. So it's just an interesting thing to see, and it would be, we would want to go potentially back if the community was interested. And see how this changes with increasing temperatures. I'd like to switch now to a study in wildfires that we've done, looking at extreme weathers. We have a study that's set up through multiple years in Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and California. This is a very large study. There's over 1,000 miles between study sites in multiple years. So I'm just going to give you a teeny piece of the efforts here that have been, that we have completed and actually have ongoing. So in this study, we have different samplers, same kind of technology in the sense it's passive sampling. We do have chemical movement samplers, but what I want to talk about this afternoon is we had paired samplers inside and outside at the same home. So these were just really almost feet apart at the same home during, before wildfire events, impacted wildfire events, and then after wildfire events. I'm again only going to be able to show you a piece of this and not the fake piece, but just comparing the indoor and outdoor polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons before, during, and after wildfires. And over here is just a picture again of Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and Northern California, and just the impact of wildfires. I believe is the picture in 2020. And what we see, I have now some sites from, again, before wildfires. And the bottom figure, I have low molecular weight pHs, so 2 and 3 ring pHs. And in the top figure, I have larger molecular weight pHs, like 4 and 5 ring pHs. And if I go back to the bottom, what you can see is the brown figures. We see indoor pHs are much higher than outdoor pHs before wildfire. And we see a similar thing with trend with indoor pHs are much higher than outdoor pHs before a wildfire. And so then, of course, we sampled when there was a wildfire. So the same kind of setup, only I just to reiterate here, I didn't mention in the previous slide, we have these ordered in order of increasing air quality index. So the Carson, Washington is the lowest, and the Corvallis, Oregon was the highest. In fact, Corvallis, Oregon was that picture I showed a couple of slides ago, and the AQI was something like over 500. So again, on the bottom here, the brown represents indoor pHs, and the green represents outdoor. So even during wildfires, we see that the low molecular pHs are higher indoors than outdoors. And what we see with the high molecular weight is that they're similar, once we get into the high AQI sites during a wildfire, our high molecular weight pHs are indeed higher than outdoors than indoors. But what's interesting is that pHs are higher indoors than outdoors until that AQI kind of tips over 140, 150 for the high molecular weights. And it's still higher indoors than outdoors, even it at these high AQI times. So that was an interesting finding for wildfires. And we're continuing, and we have other studies, and I'll be glad to answer questions when we at the end here. The last piece that I would like to share with you is Hurricane Harvey that hit the Houston area. And we looked using now, we're going to look at wristbands, which measure a whole host of chemicals in the same way that passive samplers do. And I'm going to go into a few extra chemicals. But we had a study where we had folks wear the wristband right after Hurricane Harvey when there was still flooding. As you know, the storm stalled and there was a lot of flooding as that storm slowly moved through the area. And then there was cleanup. And so we have participants participating in the study. And then we waited a year later when everyone was pretty much recovered from what they told us in their questionnaire. And we sampled those exact same people again. And so we were able to get about 100 people who participated in both the first sampling event and the second sampling event. And as I mentioned at the outset, we don't know a priori a lot of times what the chemicals of exposure might be. Certainly there's some usual suspects, but there's probably, and we have found that there is more than just the usual suspects. So this study, again, is about 100 people that participated in both when the flooding and cleanup was happening and after the flooding, again, 2017 and 2018. And what we see is in the blue dots, this is a person during the hurricane cleanup, the flooding cleanup, and then the little dotted line connects to them a year later when there was no cleanup and things had returned to normal. So you can see the 99 folks and the dots between them connect the two people who are paired, and or they are the same person, but their wristbands are paired with the hurricane and after the hurricane. And so what we see is that generally, although the changes are relatively small, but generally we see that chemical exposures, whether it be flame retardants or industrial chemicals or pesticides, that a lot of these chemicals, in fact, are higher during the hurricane flooding than they are post-hurricane flooding. There's a lot of data to go into here, but in the interest of time, I'll keep moving along. Another way to look at the data is in the post-hurricane. I've just now collapsed like flame retardants. You can see we have 81 post-hurricane versus 25 nanomoles after the hurricane. But you can also see that the distribution is changing. So there's some really, it's fascinating data, and we're still going through a lot of all of this to understand what it all means. And then to close, I just want to reiterate that all of these projects were community engaged or citizen science in the case of the wildfires. And in all cases, we reported back to the community before releasing any information to the public, and that there was usually an iterative process with focus groups and otherwise to ensure that we were reporting back in a responsible and effective way for the community itself. So I hope I've been able to show you that extreme weather, whether it's chemical characterizations of just the changes or actual chemical movement between compartments, environmental compartments, and chemical exposures are certainly one of the things, and many of the things we can use our passive sampling for and exploit that. So that I'd like to thank everyone. All the speakers have alluded to, there's lots of people to thank, my research team, but also lots of collaborators. And I'll take questions if you have any.
Great, thank you, Kim. That was fantastic. So we have several questions in the Q&A box here. First one was, why was St. Lawrence Island chosen for this project?
Yes, St. Lawrence Island was chosen because the community reached out to us. So it's actually an unfunded project, that I did, because it just seemed like they had a real need, and they had some really specific questions that both we had the capability and the technology to do. So it was mostly a reach out from the community to us, and one that we could answer. So we did. We stepped up and answered.
That's awesome. Next question is, residual waste are a problem, i.e. microplastics. Same with PFAS and forever chemicals. Do you have any thoughts on these issues?
Yeah, well, plastic's kind of a whole nother category than chemicals, right? So they're sort of just mentally, for a chemist, very different. Our sampler would not pick up microplastics. We could do PFAS. We haven't. I have a colleague, Dr. Jennifer Field, who's a really renowned expert in the PFAS world. And we just haven't crossed paths enough to make that happen. But the passive samplers could look at PFAS. We could. We just haven't gotten there yet. I have 1,530, and that's, the Hurricane Harvey project is something like 700,000 data points, chemical data points, not counting all the questionnaire and all the metadata, just measures, quantitative measures we have. We have about 750,000 data points. Wow. So, it's like I keep adding more to that, but then there's always the next question. So I have 1,500 chemicals, and I always get the, yeah, you have 1,500 chemicals, but did you do my favorite one, which is now PFAS? And so we're lucky, and actually Ricky Scott and I have already been talking about it, and we're ordering standards probably as we speak.
Oh, great. So in that regard, it's like, do the flame retardant constituents bioaccumulate in the sediment? So at what rate, which constituents were more than others? And also, do the fire retardants contain PFAS like in the AFFF firefighting foams?
I would guess so. I don't have data I would just be speculating on that. We've seen a lot of the fire retardants different replacements sort of as that science has evolved with products that are being used. So I would guess that we would see PFAS in the sediments and the water column for that matter, but we just haven't looked.
Okay, well, awesome. Given the information in the last talk suggesting that changes in chemicals and products over time may result in lower post-hurricane exposures, do you think that using post-hurricane wristband measurements at baseline may underestimate pre-hurricane baseline?
I don't have data to say whether or not a hurricane has changed someone's behavior from what they would have done pre-hurricane to post-hurricane. I don't have data to say whether or not that did. We've had, I think every time we interact, I'll say this, every time we've interacted with the community, I oftentimes get a lot of very thoughtful looks that people don't always know some of the exposures. So having that information almost always, regardless of a hurricane or extreme weather event, almost always changes their behavior. Whether it's using different personal care products, because we lit up one of the chemicals that's in a air freshener, and the participant didn't realize that. To flame retardants, choosing different furnitures or covering furniture, or using different ways in which to clean. Almost always when we interact with the community, we see that the community changes because of the information we've shared with them.
Interesting. So are there, will other locations in Alaska be considered for this project, i.e. the North Slope or Northwest Alaska?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, it was a freebie. So at this point, I'm sure the team wants to go up. It's very exciting locations. But I don't have anything right now funded to go into the North Slope. But it's an interest, obviously, because we're seeing potential movement of chemicals with warming temperatures that may have been stabilized 12 months out of the year because of those temperatures, now having a season or a part of a season where they're not as stabilized due to temperature increases.
Have you tested for these contaminants in agricultural lands?
Oh, yeah. The most of the studies I've done probably are in agricultural lands more than in urban areas, mostly just the hurricane and some of the Superfund work that we do are more urban oriented. But we have many locations, both in North America and some of our international studies that are all in agricultural areas. And interestingly enough, for example, one of our studies in West Africa, where it's a very agricultural rural area, is they don't have any flame retardants in their exposures because many of the products that contain flame retardants haven't migrated into Western Africa. So we see very low flame retardants as an example in that rural area.
Interesting. Well, there's a technical question here. What is the range of hydrocarbons that are within C1 to 18?
The range of, as in, not sure I understand the question. The range of hydrocarbons. So, if there is the questionnaire asking about alkylated C1 alkylated pHs, C1 through C18. Could you read the question again,
Richard? Yes. Yeah, so what is the range of hydrocarbons that are within C1 to 18? And then he followed up with yes to your question.
I'll ask the question person to maybe add more information after the talk. I'm sure. Going to guess, and I hope I guess right. The alkylateds, so pHs also have a series of alkylateds, and C1 is one methyl group on a parent pH. So you would call that naphthalene C1. You can have two methyl groups, three methyl groups. They would be called C2, C3, et cetera. And those are used expose more aquatic tox because the alkylateds drive the aquatic toxin remediation usually, but they're also used in forensics. I didn't present that data. We do have that data, of course, because we do the forensic pHs. You can't get a C18 naphthalene because you can't really put that many alkylateds on it very easily without really long chains. So they're not very common. But I didn't present that data here. I'm not sure I've answered the question. I feel badly. I don't understand what exactly is being asked.
We can follow up in the Q&A box afterwards. There's a last question here, looking at the time. How can medical physicians use the information gathered from the wristbands to improve quality of health? And how can we increase access to the wristbands here in the United States?
Well, I do have a disclaimer here that there is a company, and I do have a management interest or management plan that people can buy wristbands from MyExposome. And they can also just, use them in their research. Clinicians oftentimes have told me that the ways in which they use the data is in part to understand what's exposure. So like, for instance, the person who had asthma and they didn't realize that their air freshener had some very specific pHs in the air freshener and that those have been associated with increased asthma. So it's contextualized in that way that they can look at what does that specific patient have for exposures, and do we know have any information about those chemicals and other disease endpoints?
Okay, well, thank you so much, Kim. So if you have any additional questions, go ahead and put them into the Q&A pod, and and Dr. Anderson can go ahead and answer them directly. So I think we'll switch to the next slide presentation. Great, thank you. So before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on. It contains information, important resources, such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and a link to our feedback form. You know, we ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form here from these links. And we do look at your comments, and we try to continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. So you can request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. So next slide, please. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any webinars. For more information on the EPA CLUIN webinars, please refer to the website cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. We encourage you to visit the RISC e-learning webpage and subscribe to the RISC e-learning listserv for information about the upcoming sessions. You can also follow this, the Superfund Research Program on Twitter. Finally, links to the recordings. If you missed the first two sessions, the recorded archives are now available online. A recording from today's webinar will be available soon. And last but not least, I would take great pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Bill Sook, who is the director of the Superfund Research Program, who will give some closing remarks. So, Bill, take it away.
Thank you, Richard. I appreciate it. Okay, so first of all, I want to thank everybody for being here. I want to conclude. I want to let you know, do you have my slides up there?
Yeah, we can see your slides.
Okay, cool. Okay, sorry. Okay, good. I just want to let you know that we recently published a commentary in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. The commentary describes how SRP's multidisciplinary systems-focused approach can be used as a model to help overcome the challenges from climate change and pivot to additional needs as they arrive. It also mentions several of the examples covered during this webinar series. Next slide, please. Thank you. Here we go. Sorry. I would like to sincerely thank our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentation with us today. And that concludes today's presentation and this series. What you see here is, as Richard just mentioned, these have been archived. These are available for further use and present and information to be shared. So please feel free to take advantage of this and have a good long weekend. Thank you. Thank you. And Richard, thanks a lot for all your help.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. And everyone, I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving holiday.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care, all.